So, get this. I'm about to interview John Foss, one of the legends of modern unicycling. He started riding a unicycle in the 1970s and was a multiple world champion in many unicycle events. If there was a lifetime achievement award for services to unicycling, John Foss would be one of the first recipients. In 1980, he attended his first nationals, that's the American National Unicycle Meet, organised by the USA, the Unicycling Society of America. And just a couple of years later, he was one of the people who helped set up and promote the IUF, the International Unicycling Federation. This is the international organisation that organises the Unicycling World Championships, the Unicons. And when it comes to unicycling, John Foss literally wrote parts of the rule book. As a pioneer, he helped the International Unicycling Federation grow across the planet and has seen and helped promote the arrival of just about every single form of unicycling, from track racing to mountain unicycling, from trials to unicycle basketball. Performing as the Unicyclone, he has entertained audiences across the world. Look, so, I'm in Hong Kong, and he's in America. I'm going to interview him over Zoom. And as I'm walking to my office, who's walking by but a certain Mr. Steve Dressler? That's right, Mr. Steve Dressler, who knew John Foss all those decades ago when the first Unicons were being organized back in America. That's right, Steve Dressler and John Foss, who helped set up unicycling federations, who took the International Unicycle Federation to China and to Hong Kong. They hadn't spoken, I don't know, for decades. Possibly. Anyway, I mean, what could I do? I could only say, hey, Steve, guess who I've got on my computer, on Zoom? Come up and say hello.
Hey, John. What's up, buddy?
Oh, my goodness. It's Steve Dressler.
Goodness, huh? I'm glad you still think that way about me.
Yeah, well, that's the public-facing view, you know.
Well, you know me better, okay, so.
But what do you do these days?
Well, the same thing I did when you were here last time.
Okay.
You don't remember, huh?
How do you remember?
Well, I remember way back it was working with expat people, moving them in and out.
Yeah. Well, you're certainly not, you haven't descended into Alzheimer's yet.
Not yet.
I'm still doing it. I'm moving the house right next to Ben.
This was not planned, John. I came into my office this morning, and someone said, "Hello, Ben." It was him. And then I went up to my office on the 28th floor. And there were all his guys on the same floor. What a chance. Total coincidence.
So how do you know Ben?
He doesn't really.
Yeah, I don't really.
No, let me tell you.
Okay.
The last time I saw you was in Guildford in 1996. I saw you doing your show, the Unicyclone, at the Unicon.
Unicyclone, that's right, yeah.
And then in 2004... I was in, put that down, Steve. In 2004, I got off the plane in Tokyo to go to the Unicon there. And I was the guy who was videoing absolutely everything. And you were there at the airport waiting for the bus to take us to the convention. And I remember you saying, "You must have a lot of tape." Because I was videoing every single thing.
Okay, well, listen, this was absolutely not planned, but what a delightful reunion here.
Yeah.
Give my regards to Jackie, and stay on top, my friend.
Absolutely.
I'll be back in a moment.
Sorry, yeah, I'm going to have a bad friend.
I love juggling, and the best place to buy all things juggling-related is oddballs.co.uk. That's oddballs.co.uk. I've been going to their shop since the 1980s, and now you can go there online too. The staff at Oddballs really know what they're talking about, Will the juggling axe, a fire torch, and the juggling club work while I balance on a roller bowler?
Yes, says the staff with oddballs, because they've actually tried it. True story. They also sell bubble equipment, yo-yos, lassos, stilts, diablos, roller bowlers,
and unicycles.
The list goes on and on and on. So, visit oddballs.co.uk right now and get yourself some juggling equipment. I did it back in 1988 and built a whole career out of it. The links and contact details for Oddballs are all in this episode's description.
And before we get started, a quick reminder to keep my costs down. Not every single episode is available as a downloadable podcast all the time. But they are all available on my website, thebigbenshow.com/podcasts. So if there's an interview you really want to listen to, just go to my website and listen there. And if, like me, you are fascinated by all the tips, all the performers, all the references mentioned in this podcast, and you want to learn more, then just go to my website, thebigbenshow.com/podcasts, and there you will find detailed show notes for every single episode, as well as the occasional video and photo. Alrighty, let's get back to John Foss.
So, John Foss, I almost want to call you Sir John Foss, really, because you've watched the sport of unicycling grow from, in your own words, from obscurity to a much larger and diverse form of obscurity. And I've told you how I met you. I saw you at Unicon 8 in Guildford in Kent doing your unicyclone routine. And then at Unicon 12 in Japan, I got off the plane and I was videoing absolutely everything. And I put the camera right into your face and you said, "You must have brought a lot of tape." So, John, it's a real pleasure to actually get to chat to you. How and when and why did you first learn to ride a unicycle?
Well, how? Very badly. Yeah. we'll go into that. When? Approximately 1976.
Yeah.
And why? I don't know. I think I know. I have bits and pieces of that, and I try to remember things. But yeah, as a little kid, well, first of all, okay, growing up in Detroit, Michigan, my dad is an automotive engineer. He's a collector of model cars, is a 1/43rd scale. So I'm in a world of cars and vehicles and books of cars and this and that. So there's a fascination that's possibly genetically built in, though he wasn't from Michigan. He's from Wisconsin. But so that was there. I know that children's books, like Dr. Seuss books, always had fanciful vehicles. He always drew crazy vehicles. That was probably some kind of influence. And when I was either 5 or 6 years old, we went and saw the Detroit Thanksgiving Day Parade in person, rather than on TV, where things are very small back in the day. We saw it like front row center where the parade starts off. Yeah. And there was a big unicycle group in the parade. And that left an impression on me. Mm. It was either there was a big unicycle club from Pontiac Unicyclists that hosted the first nationals, actually a few years after this. So like 20 unicycles, all sizes up to 10 or 12 feet.
Yeah.
It was either them or the King or the St. Helens school, school where most of the kids rode unicycles. But
wow.
I don't know. I'm not sure what year it was to get the answer of which group that was. But I remember being told that year or a different year that it was a school, you know, where the kids rode unicycles. Like, oh, if all the kids in the school can ride one.
Yeah,
that means everybody can ride one. Yeah. And so a seed was planted, but then I was like 5 or 6, and it wasn't until I was about 14 when a neighborhood kid had a unicycle, and all the other kids were trying it, And around that time, my next door neighbor mentioned, oh, I have one. You want to borrow it?
Oh.
I was like, oh, really? Okay, sure. And it was this Troxel, this red unicycle with a, I think, 16-inch solid plastic tire, tricycle cranks. And actually not a bad seat, not a bad seat height for such a toy.
Okay.
But no bearings, you know, nylon bushings. And so it was kind of crap. It was made out of tricycle parts by a company that made tricycles and called the juvenile bicycle market. So I started trying to ride that thing, but it's terrible because the pedals are small, pretty widely spaced, mm-hmm. and the crank arms are ridiculously short because they're designed for, you know, a 3-year-old riding a tricycle.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of struggle. I was in the basement holding on to things. We had to quarter down the basement and back and forth, and throw it in the corner and yell at it, but then be like, nope, try again. After maybe 6 weeks or so, I started to get it. You know, I started to be able to ride it without holding on, and took it outside, started going down the driveway and making turns, but every time I would try to turn, the tire would just go up against the side of the because the way it was built was a poor engineering.
Yeah.
So the wheel was held in by one bolt on each side, and it would just twist. And I couldn't repair that. I didn't have tools or funding at the time. So then there was a 3-year gap. Then my next door neighbor, or a guy around the corner, got the Schwinn 6-foot-tall unicycle.
Oh, yeah.
So I start seeing him riding that thing. I'm like, wow, that's cool. But it was many months before I considered the idea of, well, why don't I just get on that and try to ride, you know, that after 3 years of barely being able to ride, which I did. You know, I'm 17, and so I don't break. You know, so I rode it off the back of a car. Back in those days, you could stand on the hood of a car and not damage it.
Yeah.
So you stand on the front, back the wheel up against the front tire, and it was just the right height to just walk away like a curb mount.
Yeah.
That's how I learned to finish learning how to ride on a proper unicycle.
So you properly learned to ride for the first time on a giraffe unicycle.
Yeah, sort of. You could put it that way. And like I said, I don't recommend it as a learning method, but it works if you're 17 and you've got lots of time on your hands.
Do you have any tips for someone who wants to learn how to ride a unicycle?
Don't quit because you will get it. But it's one of those things that it's worth doing because it seems so impossible at the beginning. When you have conquered it, when you can finally ride the thing, you will be able to fairly say, hey, I've done the impossible. And now I'm going to, you know, put that on the shelf, or I'm going to keep doing it and have more fun with it, you know, whatever people want to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. Just persist. And I would say some people say hold on to walls. I would say just go for it. Just start riding out into open space.
It depends on who you are.
Yeah.
Your age, size, and attitude.
Yeah, okay. That's true.
Small children need spotters. Younger kids, like under the age of 8 or so, they're going to take longer to learn than bigger kids because they're just not as developed cognitively or you know, physically.
Yeah.
But you get into, you know, like 8 to through teenager or 8 to 30, just hand them the unicycle and say, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, and that'll probably be your quickest way. You know, with a little bit of encouragement and, you know, there's things to know that you can do. What I get from reading the online forums, unicycling forums, a lot of people with questions when they're learning, and they're always asking about equipment. Should I switch to this wheel, or should I buy another one? Should I do this or that? It's like, well, yeah, go ahead and buy another one if you want. It doesn't benefit me, but it's good for the business, the industry. But the equipment, changing equipment's not going to teach you how to ride. What you have is going to be fine unless it's crappy.
Yeah.
You know, just getting in a cycle that isn't junk. And and that'll be fine. And then once you learn to ride, you can decide what type you need and get get more specialized. You know, do you want to bang up and down on it and get to trials? You want to ride on the trails? You know, uh-huh. You want to pay for that or just ride around? There's, you know, your basic motorcycles.
Yeah. There you go, because you started off on a really crappy little unicycle, and then eventually you got hold of your friend's giraffe, and that's where you probably started to ride. So it doesn't matter what unicycle you have, as long as it's not going to fall to bits.
As long as it works, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the first one I bought was one to match his, so we could ride on and be on the same level. We also had a borrowed 20-inch Schwinn, which I still have.
Wow.
I mean, the guy eventually sold it to us, and I used it in Unicon 1 to win the pairs competition. Now it just hangs in a garage.
Yeah.
Like most of the unicycles. And the red piece of crap that I learned on, I keep that as a hey, here's what a crap unicycle looks like. Stop bitching about your 21st century cheap unicycle.
Yeah.
Century, man. Yeah, be happy.
All right. So this is something that surprises me, because I grew up in the UK and there wasn't a local unicycle club. I didn't see anybody. No neighbor had a unicycle. Nobody had a unicycle. But where you grew up in the 1970s, there were other unicyclists, and was there really a local unicycle club?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is not common. You know, they exist and they have existed here and there, but a lot of unicycle clubs don't necessarily last more than a few years. You know, it's a group of people that get together and they do it, or it's a family that a bunch of kids get together and the parents kind of run it. But then the kids grow up and they tend to fade away.
Yeah.
Which hasn't happened with my local club, the Redford Township Unicycle Club, the next town over from Livonia, where I grew up. They were an offshoot of the Pontiac Unicycle Club, which was a much larger club, and they started one for two reasons. One is it was kind of a 25, probably 45-minute plus drive each way to get there.
Yeah.
And their performing group, they were really good. They had a lot of the top riders of the time, being somebody was starting to do national conventions and people were having a chance to say, oh, this person's really good. This person's average. This person sucks. But their show group was limited to the top 25 riders. And
okay.
So if you're a new and up and coming kid, you're 40th in line. And it's like, we're never going to be in this show.
Yeah.
Okay, let's make our own club. And their philosophy was everybody performs regardless of, you know, skill. And that gives you a different philosophy of what your club is. And that club has survived the generational gap and is still going. They started in 1974, and I don't know, now it's, 45
years. Yeah, I think I've seen it on Facebook when I'm doing my searches for unicycle groups. Yeah, this is there.
And they hosted a few nationals, including 2017.
So yeah, let's talk about that. So you went to your first nationals, that's National Unicycling Convention.
Then it was called NUM, National Unicycle Meet.
You are. And you went to your first one in 1980.
Yeah.
So do you know when these nationals began?
Yeah. 1973 was the first official nationals under the name of Unicycling Society of America.
Yes.
There was one before that, which the Unicycling Society counts as number one. That was 1971 in Central Park, New York City. And there's pictures from that in the unicycle book by Jack Wiley, 1973. The maybe the only, you know, real book of unicycling that existed then.
Yeah.
And it was sponsored by a company that made crap unicycles, similar to mine, only they were better. Stelber was the company. And they worked with Bill Janak, who was the guy who,
yes,
you know, founded the this stuff. He was the go-to person for people looking for information about, you know, unicycling outside of, you know, bicycle companies. And he supposedly said, yep, I would love to help you with this event. You know, there's just make sure there's no assumed endorsement of your product, you know.
But, yeah.
And so that was a cool event, which I know a little bit about, but obviously I wasn't there.
That was my next question. Did you ever, this is from my spotty internet research, did you ever meet Bill Janak?
I spoke to him on the phone briefly.
Yeah.
This is in 1981. He was still selling unicycles. My friend Bradley ended up buying the one we were talking about. This is Miatas when they were first becoming available in the States. So he ended up ordering the uni. I had a very short conversation with him, and this is right in the beginning of me being aware of the Unicycling Society and who that was and everything like that. And within a couple of months, he had died. And so I never got to meet him in person, but I drove out there with another person from Redford to this big memorial event. It was a big celebration and show, which was you could do a whole story just on that. All these people representing all the cool hobbies that he had, square dancing and diving instructor.
Wow.
All this stuff.
This is why I love doing this podcast. You hear about these people, and they should be remembered, yeah. Because I just was Googling away, and I saw his name as maybe the creator of the Unicycle Society of America. And there you are. You spoke to the guy on the phone. Yeah.
Yeah. Father of modern unicycling. That is my what I would call him. And if I ever do a book, which what you just said is kind of a reminder that there needs to be one, because there's not a lot of documentation of that time period.
Exactly.
I mean, it's in the Unicycle book by Jack Wiley, but that's an old book. And then he did an enhanced one in 1984, which I think you can still buy, the complete book of unicycling.
Right.
But it's 1984, and so it's way behind in what the world of unicycling is now.
Yes.
Now, I did later move to New York and live in Bill Janak's house and work for his son. And learn a lot more about that world, but that came later.
Wow, what did you buy? I already know the answer. What did you buy on February the 11th, 1980?
Well, my first unicycle, the first one that I owned. Okay, so I had one to ride, and it was a regular Schwinn 20-inch. So that was a Schwinn 6-footer Giraffe.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I still have and will never part with.
Yes. Tell me about UMX in 1981-1982.
UMX was at the time seemed like the logical thing to call riding unicycles on dirt, because BMX was at kind of its height of popularity right then.
I remember, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's what we should call it, because marketing matters if you're trying to promote a sport. Something I'm still trying to convince the USA powers that be. They keep wanting to have the worst name ever for their unicycle convention, but that's another story. It's hard to remember. Nobody gets the words in the right order. The press never gets the name right unless you write it down for them. But anyway, so we called it that, but we never really did motocross. What motocross is short little races.
Yes.
And we never really did that, but that didn't matter at the time. It's like, go ride on dirt. Okay.
UMX.
And it's like, wow, this is fun. Oh, it broke. The accent broke.
These are just some random questions.
Okay.
Why did you decide to ride down the sand dunes of Belle Terre in 1985?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's before the concept of things not to do, you know, was a thing. But I think it was because then it was, you know, early days still of riding on dirt and riding on challenging terrain. It's like, I wonder if this will work. And it's actually really interesting doing it. It's very fun doing it. The 20-inch wheel sinks right up to the axle. And as long as you keep the pedals going, the wheel may squish from side to side and they're here and there. But as long as you keep it moving, you'll make it down the hill. You'll never make it up. But we did that. We did it like two or three times with one unicycle, and then we had to replace the bearings and the pedals. They're all fouled up with sand.
All right. Well, here's a big question, an important one I'd really like to know about. How and when was the IUF, the International Unicycling Federation, set up?
Well, it was originally thought up by, I mean, Bill Janak spoke of it in his writings, you know, going way back. But the person who did the legwork to get it going was Jack Halpern. You've heard of him, I presume.
Oh, yeah.
He is a guy from Israel. Mm. Okay. Sounds like you met him then. And
I'm going to try and track him down and try and interview him, yeah. If you can put me in contact with him later on, that would be great.
Yeah, he's an interesting character, though I haven't been in touch with him in many years. But a brilliant man, expert at languages. That's what he does for a living. He makes dictionaries in different languages, Japanese. So he lives in Japan, but he's Israeli citizen. I don't know if he ever got good at mastering Japanese culture. So he kind of stuck out there. But he started this in like 1982. He said, I've got this person in this country and these guys in this country and that person, you know, and we're going to say, okay, now there's this thing called the IUF. And next we have to make it more concrete and official.
Yeah.
And in 1983, after the Nationals, which a non-club group of riders hosted up in upstate New York, mm-hmm. With the help of John Janak and Merrill Schaefer and the people on Long Island, they decided, hey, why don't we go back next year and do this IUF thing in the same place? And because that one had like seven countries represented at the Nationals, many of whom were then staying at the Janak house afterwards. And that's how that got started. And then leading up to that, we put it together as a 501c3, which is nonprofit corporation, incorporated in New York, exactly the same as the Unicycling Society. So at the core, they have the exact same corporate structure and rules. And that's what it started out as. It was kind of a copy of the Unicycling Society, only international. We're going to do a newsletter. We're going to do a world championship every year. People pay a membership fee, and we'll see if that works.
It
did, and it didn't. We made changes after three Unicons. It was like after four Unicons. The second one wasn't until 86, mm-hmm. Due to we were going to do it in 85, but the building we couldn't get the building, and we're like, okay, skip it. But then 86, 87, 88, at the end of that, everyone's like, oh, my God, can we do this like every other year? This is a lot.
It's like my podcast. It was once a week, and it became, I think this is too much. I think once a month is enough.
Yep. It's like the Olympics, Yeah. Even 4 years. 4 years, those are huge. Even a big Unicon now in Europe, those are gigantic undertakings.
Yeah.
You got to hand it to those people for making it work.
I know.
You got to help them. If you go, you just got to help.
Yeah. It's one of the things. When I was a student, I loved organizing things and setting stuff up. But now I'm an adult, I just get too stressed. I wouldn't be able to handle it. All those people from all over the world, and you've decided to host them and put on all the events. Hats off to them, people who do that. Very brave.
Yeah, well, it's brave and it is very stressful and this and that. But if you get all the people jumping in and just helping out, not having to manage it, it's quite fun and it's a great way to meet the people. Like my wife always, back in the day, she would always go and be the timer on the what we now call the IUF slalom. It used to be called the obstacle course, and she would time everyone and meet all the riders, in the process. That was fun. Let's see. At the last in Spain, I helped with registration. I was doing people paying for the housing at the school or whatever type of dormitory housing they had. So they're going through this long line of tables with the various things. And at the end, they're paying for the housing. And I got the paper. I look at the paper. They're giving me cash. I'm putting cash in this little box. This is happening for like 3 hours straight. And I'm like, there is like 10,000 euros of cash in this box.
And
I'm trying to get somebody's attention and say, hey, somebody want to make a deposit here? We're not out in the middle of nowhere. We're in the middle of a city.
But for anybody who's listening to this and doesn't know much about what we're talking about, a unicorn is the World Unicycle Convention and Championships. And it's a huge meeting of unicyclists from all over the world. It lasts about a week. And it happens once every 2 years in normally a different country around the world. And it follows, the competitions follow the rules laid out in the IUF, the International Unicycling Federation rule book. Did you help write parts of that rule book back in the day?
Yeah, and actually today's Unicons, at least in Europe, and I say Europe because that's where you get the most riders being able to attend in a cost-effective way. So you get, I don't even know, there were like 1,400 or 1,500 riders at the Spain.
Yeah.
That was 2016. And yeah, so it's a massive event. And think of it like the Olympics.
Yes.
Where all the sports are done on unicycles. Not all the Olympic sports, our sports, but
there's
quite a wide range. So you need a lot of venues and a lot of organizing to make it work.
Oh, like we say, hats off. I mean, I would hate to be in charge of that sort of event. Oh, my God. Wow, amazing.
Yeah, and I know from watching it grow, even in the early days, it was a big deal. We started out with the rules that we used for the Unicycling Society of America conventions, which were, it was a lot less events then. We had track racing, several different distances, 4x100 relay, 100, 400, 1500, 1600 in those days. No, we did yards in those days. like the old days. And we had a 1 foot race, backwards race, wheel walk race. And then we did, in the gym, we did what we now call freestyle. And several other events, individuals, pairs, groups. And there were some other events then, but those were the vast majority of it.
Yeah.
Now, there's two little categories in a much, much larger world.
Yeah, if I can just jump in. When you say things like pairs and freestyle, basically, if you don't know what this is, think of like when you watch an ice skating competition and the music plays and someone's ice skating to music. That's what pairs is, isn't it? Things like that.
Yeah, with a little less politics and a lot more variety. Because ice skating these days kind of looks, it's a bunch of pretty stuff in between the big jumps that matter.
Oh, that's true. I haven't watched ice skating for a while.
And actually, top level freestyle for the Japanese riders is starting to look like that too. You got your big, difficult skills that you have to wind up for and, jump up on top of the wheel and get your foot up behind the back of your head. Like, those are crazy hard tricks with high consequence. You know, if you mess up, there's no way to cover that. It looks messy. But there's freestyle means you can do whatever you want, but it's a combination of skill and performance. It's an entertainment thing. If some people don't like that, it's like, well, then don't do it. Do one of the other ones.
Yes.
Other things. Yeah. So we started with the Unicycling Society rules, and we changed it to meters, changed a few things. But so it started off very simple, but then it grew and grew and got more complicated. And now it's all done by committee. So it's a long process, but we end up with a much more refined set of instructions at the end.
Better
writing. My writing is constantly being improved by people who grew up speaking other languages.
There you are.
That's what Americans are. What do you call someone who speaks three languages? You know, it's trilingual. What do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks one language? American.
What newsletters did you write, and how were they distributed back in the early days?
So the Unicycling Society had a quarterly paper newsletter, black and white, obviously, or else it would have cost a fortune. And I took over that as editor in 1982, and tried to up the game a little bit, make it a little more designy. You know, it was done on a typewriter then, because that's what was available. You know,
yeah.
Bill Janek started this, and he was to unicycling what Isaac Asimov was to write books. He was crank out 40 letters a day on the typewriter. So I got a better typewriter, and then I got a Canon Bubblejet word processor.
Wow!
Right when inkjets weren't called inkjets yet, and the word processor could remember what you typed, you know, so you could correct it. It was this whole crazy thing with a tiny little display and different fonts and this and that. But anyway, did that, but only up through mid-84 when we started up the IUF. And it's like, yeah, folks, I'm going to go do an IUF newsletter. Good luck with your newsletter. It wasn't happy parting for the two groups. There was some friction there.
Yeah, I bet.
And the IUF really did start, you know, the active part started in the United States. So it was a bunch of people leaving from the national organization. People were like, oh, wait a minute, what about us? It's like, hey, this has to happen. We got to get the world on board here.
And yeah,
you gotta make this. Yeah, and I like where it's going.
So you've got the newsletter, you've got the IUF set up. So how do you go about trying to spread it around the world?
I don't know.
this is pre-internet, really, isn't it? This is like.
Yeah, we're writing letters.
How do you find the other clubs?
I mean, we're not even talking on the phone that much because long distance is expensive.
Yeah, so
when we did talk on the phone to Asia or whatever, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
So in those days, yeah, it's still word of mouth and trying to get press coverage.
Yeah.
Which it's always difficult at least at the medium, small to medium conventions, because the people running it are completely consumed with running it. They don't have the bandwidth left over to deal with, you know, getting the press to show up and then walking them through everything. So it's nice if you have a person who can handle that. And so I always try to help out on that part if it's happening. That works, but that's usually local. It's great when you get the larger coverage, like at Unicon 6, we had a TV crew from a ESPN show called Amazing Games. And that show, I don't know if that show, the guy who was hosting it was a former football star, and then he passed away a year or two later, and I don't know if the show continued after that. But the one episode that we got, that we were featured in, it also had an international fireworks competition. It had, indigenous style canoe racing in Canada, you know, with long canoes, and you know, kind of a niche thing for the people in I can't remember what part of Canada it was.
Yeah,
but they have their big event. It was a Canada show. It was almost all Canada based activities, and the Unicon was in Quebec City. Fascinating show, and they did a really great piece. And they didn't even stay for the whole convention, but they got great coverage of what was there.
Yeah.
So yeah, internet changed a lot, but that came later.
So that must have been like quite a big point, getting some good TV coverage. Were there any other turning points that helped make it truly an international event around with people coming from all over the world? I guess the internet must have made a big difference.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, when I first got a computer in 1992, that was AOL in those days. AOL mailing out those floppy disks to everyone.
Yeah.
This is how early I got in. My AOL handle was Unicycle.
Wow.
So I beat all the other unicycles there. But So that was there. And then I think in 1994 or so, I discovered a unicycling mailing list. So it was an email list you could write into and share all the messages back and forth between people. And there were people from around the world in that. It was fairly small at the time, but it was neat because it was instant communication. It was so novel. Yeah.
Yes. You know,
it was a big deal. There weren't much pictures in those days. It was mostly text because the bandwidth was so small, and posting a picture was complicated. You had to get it from film over to scan, blah blah blah.
You had to type in order to create a picture. You'd have to use all the various funny symbols like the hashtag and the @ sign and the arrows, the line by line to make it look like a picture sometimes.
Yeah, I never made those because I'm a photographer. But it's like, first you have to find a friend who has a scanner. Scan your pictures. Don't make them too big because nobody would be able to download it. That's why you go to my website, which a lot of it is still circa 1995. All the photos are tiny.
Unicycling.com,
by the way, if you want to take a trip in the Wayback Machine, unicycling.com.
Yes, you should check it out. All right. You were very good at track racing, especially in the early days. Have you got any tips for going really fast on a unicycle?
Practice. and again, equipment's not that important. You'll see people who get those 26-inch by 1-inch tires, which just barely fit the size spec. And if you inflate the tire too much, then it's like, oh, no, can't use that. Okay, how about now? No, that's not going to make that big of a difference. What you got to do is learn how to spin fast.
Yeah.
And to win the sprint races, like the 100 meters is like the big major track race, even though it's over in, over in 20 seconds. You got to learn how to accelerate really hard, how to transition from that acceleration to cruising without falling off, and then how to hold that fast cruise and leave a little bit left over so you don't override, your balance point. You just have to, and the important thing in track is you have to finish the race. If you fall off, you're out.
There you go.
That's the short races. 800 and above, you can get back on.
Do you know who first realized, it's obvious really, who first realized shorter crank arms is going to be faster?
It doesn't matter for track. We have rules for that. It's like NASCAR. You have to 125 is the minimum.
It's the limit.
Then there's a wheel size limit, but everything else is pretty much there's not that much else. But people did find that limiting, and I've always wanted to change that and say, okay, we've been doing this with these long cranks
in
track for so many years, and back then we did it because that's what you could buy.
Yes.
So you could buy a unicycle, had the right size, off you went. If you change that to 100, you're going to get faster times, faster people, but you'll also get maybe worse crashes. Don't get too much crashing in track. I mean, it's not that dangerous. I mean, it's way more dangerous in some of the other events. But they've kept it. I tried to get a 700C racing class to work. That's a 29-inch wheel, or in those days, like road bikes, it was 700C, whatever that means. It's about a 29-inch tire. And we did it at that Unicon in Japan, and the one after that, and maybe the one after that. And people were just like, I don't want to have to bring that wheel along with my 24.
That's right. I remember watching the 10-kilometer race in Japan in 2004, and there were some unusual unicycles in that race.
Yeah, that one had an unlimited class along with the other 24-inch, I think. And the unlimited in those days was anything over 24-inch or crank arms shorter than the 125-millimeter.
Right.
So you're on a track uni or you're on a unlimited, what we call unlimited. But probably the biggest wheel in that was 29-inch because, it was pre-Coker.
Yes. Do you have a favorite memory of one of those early races that maybe you won at a Unicon? Was there an event that sticks out in your mind that you had a good race?
Well, there was a Unicon 3. There was a Guinness 100-meter race, which was cool because they ran it like 10 times. They had this group of seven or eight guys, and we fought to get this one other guy who had fallen off in the main 100 meters. It's like, no, he's really fast. Please let him go in this race. Yeah, but it's like, it's me and a bunch of Japanese guys. Let's get the Puerto Rican guy in there to mix up the track a little, okay? Okay. So we did that, and then they ran it like 10 times, and it was a big deal because we had electronic timing, which was unheard of then. It was all stopwatch. So that way you get the best possible performance out of your people.
Yeah.
And it was kind of cool because everyone kind of did about the same placing each time.
Yeah.
Me and this other kid, Shigeru Koike, and it was him or me each time.
Yeah.
Or one of us would fall off but the fastest one was me, so I ended up inching that one out. So I got my Guinness record. I was in the book for 4 years.
Yay!
It was kind of a typo because the new record was in there, but they didn't take the old one out. That's what happens. Yeah, those were good times. Also, at Unicon 2, Daniel Dumang, the Puerto Rican guy, he was one of the really fast track guys. So in our 15 or 16, I think it was 1600 meters then track race, it was a photo finish, and really dangerous at the end, especially of a longer race in track when you're pedaling really really fast, because if you try to push beyond your abilities, you're out. So you have to kind of hold on to that, so that one neither one of us could tell at the finish line who was ahead.
Yeah,
we had to leave the people on the side, and then he was happy at the at Unicon 4 when he took me out in that race, and it was the same thing. And that one we have good solid video of, and you can see the point where I pushed it to my limit, and then you could see me do this movement that said whoa, and he won, and he was so happy, and they picked him up and carried him around in the air. And the Puerto Ricans were really big on, getting whatever wins they could get.
Yes. Okay. So track racing, brilliant. But tell me also about one of your medal-winning freestyle routines from the early Unicons, because you also did a lot of freestyle, didn't you?
Yeah. Unicon 1, I won the pairs with a girl from my old unicycle club. I was still living in Michigan, so from Redford. That came out nice. If you saw a video of it, you'd be like, really, that one? Because it's so elementary and simple. But staying on counts, and not making mistakes, that is. And
yeah,
competition was a lot less fierce in those days. Unicon 2, there were really only two contenders at the higher end in the freestyle. So I got that one. And Unicon 3, I came in third, and that was accurate. No, wait, that was Unicon 1 on the individual. I came in third.
Individual, yeah.
Sam Abrahams in second, last time he ever competed in that, because he didn't win. And Peter Rosendahl was the first place, and he's a professional performer. I don't know if he's still doing it these days. I think he's not doing it
anymore.
But he did it for many, many years, a guy from Sweden.
Wow.
The last time I did freestyle was Unicon 7, so this is 1994. I broke my unicycle frame at the convention before that. We had nationals right before.
Oh, no.
Because there was this trick where I would stand on it on the side and walk the pedal.
Yeah.
Which is a non-riding trick, no points for skill, but points for, interesting. I had to borrow a different one. And while I was halfway through my performance, the music cut out.
Oh, no.
The joke at the time was Jack Halpern tripped over the cord or something. pretty sure that didn't actually happen. But then it was like, okay, what do we do? It's like, can I keep what I did up to that point? And then I'll do the whole performance over and you just judge the second half. And I said, okay.
Gosh.
And but really that was an unfinished piece. I didn't have the second half choreographed out. So I did this really cool choreography. So the judges would assume the rest of it was all choreographed. But the second half was kind of a bunch of tricks. And it worked good for third place. It was fine.
Good. Good. All right. The first few unicorns are mainly in the United States of America. Is there an early one in Japan? A very early unicorn in Japan?
Yeah, that was the Guinness race.
Ah.
Yeah, so Unicorn 1 and 2 were both in New York, different parts. 3 in Japan, 4 Puerto Rico, 5 Canada, 6 Canada, 7 back in the States, Minnesota.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. What was significant about the unicorn in 1996 in England?
First time on the continent,
that's
or
right,
whatever you call it, England, the UK.
Europe, yeah.
First time over there and accessing this whole new world of European riders to be able to go to it. It was still small, which was kind of a godsend that year because there were 4 guys that were organizing this thing.
Yeah, I sort of know them vaguely because I'm from England.
Okay, and Jonathan Marshall, he was like deathly ill, so he couldn't. He basically sat at a table and did paperwork because he wasn't in good shape. But fortunately, these big clubs that came in from Germany, Bottrop being one of the main ones, they just said, "Oh my gosh, you guys need some help," and then they just started pulling out all the stops and raising their voices up and organizing people. And without them, it never would have worked out.
Yeah. Okay. My next question is, what World Unicycle Championship events have you won? Okay. I think we've talked about this a bit, but what events have you won?
I don't know. A lot of track.
Yeah.
Freestyle that I mentioned. I won the off-road race at Unicorn 7, the Muni race. I don't think we were calling it Muni yet.
Mm.
Before the word Muni. Muni came from a guy in England, Duncan Castling.
Ah.
And it's an obvious word. It works, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Easy word. I came in second. No, this was at Nationals. I came in second in a trials competition once, which anyone who knows me would think is hilarious. Chris Holm first, then me. Then whoever. There's a couple of reasons why that's true. One is it was very new, a new thing. So mostly
yes.
People are on munis because there are no trials unicycles. Second one is a lot of people might not have known it was there. And third was lightning storm. So I was the last one on the course and it was already raining and lightning and the newspaper headline the next day. This is in Washington, up at the Summit Resort at the Snoqualmie Pass in outside of Seattle. Newspaper headline the next day was lightning strikes 10,000 times, and we had people up on the ski lifts and stuff. Yeah, you know, so getting everyone off the lifts and getting the hell out of there. That was fun times.
Wow.
What other events do we do? Well, I've been in 10K races and marathon races. I didn't do the 100K. A couple of unicorns had 100K.
Wow.
That's not my cup of tea, if you will.
All right.
I've played right. Basketball.
To go off on a tangent then, John, what about, tell me about an organization, this is total tangent, tell me about an organization called the Circus Education Specialists, and tell me about the National Circus Project.
Okay, so that's the same thing. Circus Education Specialist was the original name, corporate name. This was a company run by John Janak and Merrill Schaefer, who also organized Unicorns 1 and 2. It's a not-for-profit arts and education organization based on Long Island, originally based in the Janak home at 67 Lion Lane. And now it's based down the street at 56 Lion Lane. But And we did mostly school programs in public schools or private schools in and around the New York tri-state area, and then, you know, spreading out sometimes as far as Boston and Ohio. And I'm not sure these days, it's 20 years since I've been directly involved. But so it always would start with a show, or what they would call an assembly program, where kids would say, okay, this is what we're talking about when we talk about some circus stuff. Circus doesn't have to be in a tent, doesn't have to have animals. And now you get to try some of that stuff you just saw in the show. And it's thought of by a lot of the kids in the programs as this is a non-threatening sport type activity I can do where I'm not going to be judged. You know, so a lot of times the kids who suck at sports would do really well because they're not worried about trying and figuring stuff out, and kids learning to juggle. And it mostly was juggling. The main three tools is juggling with tennis balls for third grade and up, and scarves for second grade and down, devil sticks and spinning plates, each requiring a different set of psychomotor skills.
So you must have been involved as a unicyclist, surely, in their shows.
Yeah, rode unicycles. And now some of these schools, Long Island has a lot of cultural arts stuff. Performing for an audience of Long Island kids is not like performing for a bunch of Midwest kids. These kids have seen everything. When Ringling Brothers comes to Detroit, let's say, they're there for like three shows, you know, or 3 days or something like that, and then they're on to the next place. When they come to New York, they're at the Madison Square Garden for 6 weeks.
And then
the other unit, because back in those days they had two units going around, the other unit would also come for a stop in New Jersey and another one on Long Island right by where we had Unicon 2. So the kids are getting lots and lots of live entertainment and culture, so it's harder to impress them. But and some of these schools would have circus programs or you know, performing arts programs and things. So if they had that and they had other equipment, like, you know, little tightrope setups, unicycles, stilts, whatever stuff, we would work with them on that too. And sometimes we would do culminating event programs where we're there for the week, and at the end of the week, a select group of kids put on a show. Yeah. Those are rough weeks. That's a lot of work to get from zero.
All right. So you're performing in schools, but tell me also about performing in Latvia, in Hong Kong in 1987, and in China in 1993. How did those things come about?
Well, the circus project, we would also get bookings on the weekends sometimes, and in the off times, you know, when school is out. The international stuff was fairly rare, but it was, you know, more notable. Also, you would get booked into weird things, such as a grand opening of a supermarket. I rode my unicycle around. I got to juggle cantaloupes and otherwise be a nuisance to all the shoppers. I mean, there's two groups of people. There's the people that are connected to the company, and they're in there celebrating and drinking champagne and, you know. But then there's this other group of people that have watched the supermarket being built, and they're lined up with their carts, and they want to get their shopping done. And like, out of my way, I need some cantaloupes. You know, very weird. Fun when you're an entertainer, you get to do interesting stuff, like orientation day at a college. Yeah, you're going to ride around where people are paying their tuition and trying to move into the dorms. That one was strange. But anyway, okay, international shows. Hong Kong, my first time in Hong Kong, first time in Asia. We put that one together because Unicon 3 was coming up, you know, and we had helped put together Unicons 1 and 2, and we were involved in convincing the powers that be and helping out with Unicon 3 a little bit. So there was this international arts carnival event that's, I guess, an annual event there with different types of performing arts in various venues around the city. So we got into that with several performers. We had a magician. We had, I can't remember, clown, ringing
Crown College graduate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Milstein, yeah, yeah.
The guy, my partner at the Circus Project, and a few other people. So we did several shows there, and that paid for our trip. In other words, they paid for the plane tickets, including a stop in Tokyo.
Yes.
It was the only time I ever had a newspaper review of a show that I've been in. And it wasn't great because the little part that Greg and I did together was kind of a hastily put together interaction to kind of segue his act into mine. So that was kind of funny. I have that article someplace. But yeah, we got to see Hong Kong and perform in several different places. And I wonder if the big theater, which is down near the waterfront on the mm-hmm. on the Hong Kong side, wonder if that still exists or has been replaced by something.
I think there's still a big theater there somewhere. That was the same one. I think there's still one down there.
Yeah, I don't know if I could remember. And we did a big, beautiful, you know, glittery mall with a skating rink nearby.
Mm.
That was nice, air conditioning. Then we had to get our visas for Japan before we got on the plane because we didn't end up getting them before we left. I don't want to go into it. We got our tickets less than an hour before we had to leave for the airport. We'll be shipped from Hong Kong. So, a little stress there. But the unforgettable trips, you know, getting to do that stuff. That was Hong Kong. Latvia was an international, I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was an international youth circus convention type mm-hmm. of thing.
Yeah.
But it was mostly youth circus organizations from the Soviet Union and surrounding areas because that type of thing, that's where it exists.
Yes,
then had,
yes.
Then you had visitors from other places, you know, guests, artists, which, again, Greg Milstein and myself, we went there. We got to watch the performance. And I don't know if it was just shows or was there some competition. Probably not competition so much as it was different ages, different experience levels. Some were pretty much, for outside of Soviet Union, which had very high standards, pro-level performances by the older kids and some, you know, much younger and more basic types of things, but lots of great stuff that we got to watch and be a part of and then perform in the Riga Circus, which was had just celebrated its 100th year. Imagine a circus building that smells like 100 years of elephant. But it was so cool to be there, and quite an eye opener, you know, to see the different cultures.
Yeah,
and we were there on the day that Latvia was legally able to fly the Latvian flag for the first time since World War II.
Because
it was one of the Soviet republics.
Yes.
But they had a law, you know, this is right before it all was breaking up. And I went out to watch this flag raising ceremony. And it's in the middle of February. It's a little chilly out in the square. But it was only a few blocks from where the circus was in Riga. And there was probably at least 10,000 people there to watch. You know, a band played and speak.
Wow, fantastic.
And they lowered the Soviet Latvia flag and raised up the new one. And I looked around me, and, you know, there was some older people, you know, old enough to remember around me with tears running down their faces.
Yeah, I bet. You know,
what a cool event to be at.
Wow.
Thing. So that was very cool. That's something I get to, you know, put in my scrapbook of life.
What an amazing story. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was fun. 1993, China was China's first unicycle meet, and they put on this event called the Great Wall Marathon. I think part of the purpose of it was to help promote this, the start of unicycling in China. And later we figured out it was also to help them make their bid for the 2000 Olympics.
Wow.
Which they didn't get, but which is a good thing because they very much weren't ready at that point. But that was a very fun event. We did some shows there and we did some street racing and, you know, examples of the stuff that we do in the the Western world with unicycling. And then the Great Wall Marathon was a 10K race from the parking lot of the Great Wall Mutan U, which is outside of town, not the one in town.
Yeah.
Because it would probably be too busy. And no one had done this before. We're all used to track racing on these 24-inch unis, but on the side of a road on a hill, it was different. It's not a steep hill, but you got 5K going downhill where some people were trying gliding a little bit where your foot's on top of the tires. I don't know about doing that for 5Ks. Turn around, then you're going uphill, and nobody is used to that. It's a different kind of riding because you have to pedal harder, so you're grinding the seat more. So everybody's tearing up their crotches on the way up. I don't know if your audience, if this is audience appropriate, but Jack Halpern made a great quote when he came by, because in those days on the long race, I would finish the race, grab my camera, go back and take pictures of people coming up. So Jack Halpern rides by and he goes, I need a detachable beep.
Yeah, we'll put that in the podcast. So I might just have to bleep it out.
I can bleep that. Sorry, kids. It was, you know, I knew exactly what it meant. Everyone was like, and it was, you know, it's hot and sweaty, which makes it worse.
Do you have a favorite saddle for the longer rides?
Yeah, that's kind of a long discussion, but because it's a very personal choice.
Yeah,
Chris Holm makes a road riding saddle called the original one was called the Zero, and this one's called the One. So it's a flat. Most unicycle saddles have quite a bit of curve to them. That's to keep it from popping out. These are much flatter, and they're really designed for if you have a handlebar, because that helps helps it not want to jump out of there. And they're designed for people who ride a lot. And if you ride a lot, or at least if you ride enough, they work pretty well. They're focused on supporting your sit bones and not having a lot of foam squishing your softer areas, you know, where, you know, restricts circulation. So the Zero saddle, I never got used to. Most people didn't like. So I, you know, and the One, you know, it's visually it looks the same, but I'm riding enough now that it works, and I can hold up for quite long rides, and especially with my new invention of one old crappy pair of bike shorts underneath a pair of quality bike shorts. I did the 42-mile San Francisco unicycle tour and wasn't even thinking about my crotch at all, which that's a big deal.
That's great.
But for most people, people recommend the Fusion Free Ride, and then there's a something stadium seat. Those are both very popular for general riding.
Yes, QX stadium seat. Yeah. Again, you're right, it's totally personal. For me, I get a lot of pain from my tailbone up to my spine if I'm sitting on the wrong kind of saddle. I was born in 1971, so I'm about 50 years old now. And for me, the only saddle I like to ride is the Miata Airseat Conversion, which I built from on a very early website in the early 90s, mid-1990s maybe.
I got one of those.
Yeah.
That's on my old Coker.
So I've still got that. That's what I'm going to use until I fall off the unicycle when I'm really, really ancient. That works for me. Miata Airseat Conversion.
From what you described, it sounds like some kind of nerve is getting too much pressure on it. And as long as you can avoid that spot, it'd probably make a difference. Air seats still work, and it really depends on the type of riding and the quantity of riding to have the right thing. Because actually, my air seat on my Coker, it took me two tries to ride around Lake Tahoe. We live like an hour and a half from Lake Tahoe. A big lake that's about 20 miles long and 72 miles around, and it's more than a mile above sea level. So it's a mountain air, you know, thin air riding.
Yeah.
And they used to have an annual event that unicyclists would go to, a big, big bike event called America's Most Beautiful Bike Ride.
Uh-huh.
And it was very fun to do because all the families of the people doing it, because most of them aren't hardcore cyclists. They're people, you know, cycling for fitness. It's a fitness-based organization. So their families are out there, and they're from all over the country. And some are groups from different states. Like there was a group from Detroit, and they had 45 RPM records stuck on top of their helmets because it's Motown. And so the family members are scattered all the way around the lake at various spots, just cheering you on. Everybody who goes by, they're like, "Woo, yeah!"
A great event.
And it's the scenery is, you know, can't be beat. It's beautiful. But my first attempt, I only made it halfway around because I didn't use my brake enough on the downhills.
Oh.
And I found myself walking the downhills and riding the uphills because they didn't hurt. So the next year, I made it all the way around. But and there was a whole group of unicyclists there. It was like 12 or more unicyclists, and more than half of them did the 100-mile route. I just did the round the lake route. But I didn't figure this out until well into the ride. But that morning when I got up, and we're leaving before it's light out, my air seat was flat.
Oh.
And I eventually realized, hey, this seat is not right. And it had, somebody else had made this. I bought it from somebody, Chris Reeder, maybe. It just had a tiny little triangle of foam to kind of hold the inner tube.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the actual inner tube itself squishing around in the seat cover. Yeah. That's what I was riding on for the first half of the ride. And then we stopped at the first rest stop, but there was no, you need to be able to take the complete seat apart and dunk the tube in the water to find the leak to fix it.
Yeah.
And no time because people are going. So all the way up to the halfway point, the lunch stop.
Oh.
With Corbin Dunn, who's a brilliant do-anything engineer guy. He helped design the iPhone, among other things.
Wow.
So he helped me get the seat taken apart and find the leak so we could patch it up, because otherwise I was done. And finished the ride, and it's fun times.
Get my glasses on. What was it like to move to California and discover proper mountain trails to unicycle on?
Totally awesome, dude.
Yeah, I bet.
Spring of 96, somebody, you know, I went out, I had a day to ask. I went to the bike shop and asked the guy in the bike shop in Auburn, where the hills are, where's your best bike path around here? And he gave me these horrible directions. You know, I ended up following a road into a neighborhood on the edge of, you know, this big canyon.
Yeah.
But that wasn't working. You know, his directions were crap. But from there, I found myself on Forest Hill Road and going down a hill. And all of a sudden, I'm on this bridge that's 740 feet high. Mm. It's a Forest Hill Bridge. It's the highest bridge in California, I would later learn. And down below, I stopped where you could park and walked out on the bridge. It's, ooh, there's trails down there. bigger story, there were also people bungee jumping and hang gliding off of the bridge that day, which is something that is almost never made. You know, it's a special day. But I discovered the trails there and had to learn my way around. And that's still the best trails in the area are there, at the confluence of the North and Middle Forks of the American River.
Mm.
Auburn.
Tell me about the California Muni weekends.
Yeah. Okay. So discovered these trails in the spring of 96 and started riding on them. And I was out there with a couple of friends who were bike riders, and the idea just popped into my head. It's like, we got to do a convention out here. We have to make this a thing, because people were calling it Muni by that point. And we had done a little bit of dirt racing. Let's see, 96. What Unicon was that? That was
Guildford in England, 1996.
Oh, yeah.
They had something called Muni there. It was like it was in the woods on footpaths and dirt tracks, and it was sort of orienteering.
Yeah, it's orienteering. Yeah, I learned about nettles and about, I'm not good at that. Yeah. I didn't do well. But I finished it. The Unicon before that, or the two Unicons before that, we had a semblance of dirt race. The first one was at Unicon 4 in 1988 on a dirt road after some rain. So it was a little more interesting. There were some muddy spots. Wow. And the cool riders would go through the puddles and splash, and the lame riders would squeeze around the side. And then there was a sand pit near the end, which I have this video that somebody made. It's hilarious watching one rider after the other hit the sand pit and crash. That was fun. And to do a proper Muni event, it's like we have trails here, in the same area. We can put this together. And so that's where I got the idea. And that was in the fall of 96. So it was called the California Mountain Unicycle Weekend. And we've pretty much had something that we called that annually ever since. Some were bigger, some were smaller. They're generally smaller now because there's more to choose from.
Yes.
People don't have to travel so far. And we've had a lot of big names. George Peck was there, who some call the grandfather of mountain unicycling.
Wow.
Robert Davis came to the first two. Chris Holm, it was his first time ever riding with other unicyclists at the third
one.
Dan Heaton, who was famous in making extreme unicycling videos back in the day. This was before that. This maybe helped inspire that. Yeah, it was fun times. So Muni weekend, and immediately other people started picking up on the idea. And there was a British unicycle weekend probably within a year of that one. And then, since then, people do them all over the place.
Yeah. Have you ever ridden the Lobster?
Yeah, that was the probably the largest in terms of complexity and logistics unicycle race ever held in history. I don't know. I know they've done big stuff in Japan, but I don't think they've ever done anything like that. Mm. This was a 5-day stage race with relay teams of three riders and one support person. And the distance was about 800 kilometers, 4 days of road riding, and the middle day, which was a Wednesday, was a time trial of about 20 Ks and a criterium race in town with a live audience.
Wow, brilliant.
It was like a big professional bike race. And
that's fantastic.
They had some rules. It's like your teams, people were invited from around the world.
I know.
They said, your team can't be, you can't cherry pick the top riders, for your team. We want it to be a mix of people who kind of know each other or this or that. And there was some cherry picking, but it worked out pretty great. And yeah, it had a wide range. There was a Hong Kong presence, right?
I was living in Singapore at the time, and some of my Singaporean friends formed a team and took part.
The poor bunnies, the masticating bunnies from hell? Was that
I think so, yeah. They
yeah, all
hard work.
All on 29 inches with no gearing. So they had a hard time just because, it's just not as fast as a 36er. I don't know if they got to eat dinner at the official venues. It was hard enough for us racing, because by the time you're done, you eat the meal, then you're dealing with laundry and unpacking in wherever you're at and getting ready for the next day.
Amazing event.
There's those packets with all the coupons and come visit this and that. And it's like, sorry, just pass it through. I would love to stop. I mean, someday we're going to go back to Nova Scotia and see it, other than the road, but what an event. I'm so glad I was able to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty sure it was only going to happen once because I knew how complicated it was to do.
Tell me about the Downeyville Downhill. The Downeyville Downhill. What's that?
Well, if you're a mountain biker, you may have heard of it because I think it's a kind of a famous ride. It's also a race annually. It's a nice trail that goes from the Sierra Buttes down to the town of Downeyville, which is a gold rush town in Northern California. And it drops 4,000 feet in less than 20 miles. So I'm sorry, I don't have the metric version of any of that. But that's up more than 1,000 meters.
Yeah.
I know what 1,000 meters feels like. I did it with no brakes in Brixen, Unicon 16. Anyway, that is a great ride. And I haven't been there since I got my first Muni that has a brake on it. You know. Usually your legs get so destroyed by the downhill braking because basically when you're working the muscle while it's being extended rather than pulling it, I don't know, whatever makes your legs sore, it makes it worse.
I know. I mean, if I ride at my unicycle downhill in Hong Kong and there's some steep hills here, and I haven't got a brake on my unicycle, the muscles above your knees really ache like crazy the next day.
Yeah, I remember afterwards at work, I could walk up the stairs just fine, but I couldn't walk down the stairs. And even sitting down in my chair at work, so I had to hold on. And it was like for a week, really tough. But if you're in shape, you can actually do that without brakes and not be so much the worse for wear. But yeah. It's a long, challenging ride. But if you're up for it, it's a great, great experience. It's really pretty. It's all Gold Rush area. Yeah, it's nice.
John, you've been involved in unicycling for, let's say, a number of decades. So what trends have come and maybe gone in unicycling? You must have seen it go from, you must have seen all the new things arrive from basketball to hockey to Muni.
Basketball didn't come from us. You know, there were people doing that a long time ago.
Yeah.
You had the King Charles Troop and the World Wheelers, each of whom will claim originality, but I'm pretty sure it's King Charles. I met the guy who organized the World Wheelers. It was my first time riding a unicycle in Manhattan.
All right.
I met him at a subway station or at the Grand Central. Madison Square, where the Long Island Railroad comes in. He goes, "Hey, follow me." And he just takes off down the street, and we're zigging zagging up the sidewalk and next to buses that are moving and stuff. I'm like, wow, this is, this must be what a bike messenger feels like, only slower. Basketball, hockey. I don't know what the history of hockey is.
Yeah, I do. I've got a podcast on that. It comes from Germany. Yeah. Well, it comes from Japan. A Japanese guy went to Germany. And I've got a podcast on that.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And unicycle basketball before King Charles and World Wheelers. Not sure what was there, but I'm sure there was some form of it happening. Mm. I mean, there were some guys in Kansas who played football on unicycles in the 1960s.
Wow.
And, not football. They played a distorted form of hockey. Where they used old tires, they would wrap the tires in tape so they'd be more rigid.
Right.
And they had a block of rubber or something like that for a puck, and they'd whack that around. And on hard pavement, that was their form of hockey way back in the day. But
you must have seen Muni and trials come along because that there was no Muni and no trials when you started, surely.
Yeah, I mean you couldn't do them because you would just break the unicycle.
Yeah.
As I know from experience. I helped push some of these events to get started. Though there were always oddball events as well. The first nationals I went to was hosted by Tommy Miller, who's known as the Unicycle Factory these days. But then he was part of a unicycle club called the Kokomo Roadrunners. And they put on a nice convention, and he threw in some interesting events. He made this figure eight obstacle course race thing, which I got filmed riding in for a TV special that was done, where you had to. It was a figure eight course, so you're potentially colliding with somebody around a couple times. He made little ramps and he put these pieces of rebar on the ground. You had to ride over and
yeah,
maze with cones to go through. And so he did several fun things like that. And there were always stuff like that. One year we did a walk-a-thon, a wheel walk marathon. Who can survive the longest wheel walking? But those events are boring because somebody's always going to be really good at it.
Yes.
One time we did a giraffe freemount contest, unofficial, just during lunch at a small meet in Michigan. And yeah, it was me and this Carol Bricker. Her name used to be Carol Bahoric, but she's still around in unicycling, Carol Bricker.
It
was me and her. Up to 119 official freemounts without a miss. And then we each did one after. They said, okay, we're done. We got to get back to the regularly scheduled events. And we each did one more. So we've done 120 freemounts in a row. And I'm sure there's professional performers who do it without thinking about it and don't know how many it's been. Adding events. Unicon 4 was a big one. It went from a weekend format to a week-long-ish format because this is Puerto Rico, and they said, we're gonna highlight basketball big time because we have lots of players.
Yeah.
And basketball has always been a very squeezed-in thing up to that point. They said, no, we want to do a proper round-robin tournament and encourage more people to put together teams and play. And I think they had like a group A and group B. So you had your good players and your, you know, your novice players, which they still do now. And I have fun doing that in the novice. Like at the last Unicon, I helped organize that. So they had a full basketball tournament and they added a gliding race, downhill glide, a coasting competition, dirt race, and the first the marathon, I say with finger quotes, it was 8Ks because that was how much road they had, and it was an awesome event because they in the town there's a running club that helped, so we've only ridden 8 kilometers, but it is quite humid there, and you know people are going as hard as they can.
Yeah.
So the running club had set up a finish area just like you would have for a marathon race.
Oh, lovely.
Shower dealies set up, and everyone got a bag of fruit.
Brilliant.
And everyone was getting their picture taken in these showers, you know, just getting the water poured on them because it felt so good. And it's warm water. You're in Puerto Rico. It was a blast. Everyone that went to that convention, it was the schedule was destroyed every day, things being run, you know, running late, but everyone had the best time ever.
Brilliant.
So much cool stuff. Muni, well, we kind of did the first Muni there, but it wasn't really a thing until later. Much has been added. The types of events we have now just in Muni is cross country, a downhill race, an uphill race, and there might be other I'm missing something. We have trials now. And the trials is huge because it gets more ridiculous and more amazing each time. One of my favorite things at Unicon now is to be there to watch and take pictures.
Yeah.
I'm still honored that they let me in because I suck at trials. I can't jump very high just because I never put the time in. But they let me in there to take pictures, and you have to really, really pay attention all around. And I'm using a wide-angle lens, so I'm right up against things. So I have to constantly keep my eyes going every direction. We have trials. We have street. We have street is has a lot of pieces to it. We have high jump and long jump. Those go back quite a ways. Those are based on the Olympic high jump and long jump. Except, of course, we are men about it, or women. You have to land riding. Okay, those guys land on their back. Whoop-de-doo. We have to jump over the thing and ride away. But the unicyclists are like, yeah, but nobody does that. We try to jump up onto ledges or jump over gaps, you know, get to one railroad track to the next. So they've recently added, and they don't have great names for these. I mean, I would call the one is called platform jump,
right?
Or jump to platform. So from one set of pallets, you have to jump, or pallets or skids. I don't know what they're called.
Yeah, pallets.
Jump a gap and land on a limited space on the other ones. So there's consequence if you come up short. You're going to hit that edge, and you know, it's not.
Yeah.
But that's the real thing. That's what these guys do. So that's fascinating to watch, because every time they're pushing the known limits of that, you know, skill.
Yeah.
The platform jump, which is jumping up onto the top of a stack of pallets and things, and you have to land. You can't hook the pedal. You have to land on top. And they're up to like a meter and a half now, which is just hard to imagine.
Insanely high to jump.
Yeah. Crazy.
Wow. That's just incredible. It's really amazing talking to you, John. It's so good. But you probably need to go to sleep soon, John, I guess. Is it midnight now for you?
Yeah, my wife's going to be mad.
Okay, so I'll just finish off here. If people want to find you on the internet, should they just go to www.unicycling.com? Is that the best place to find you?
That's the best place to get a bad impression of me, because it's really old and outdated. But yeah, you can start there, and then you can link to my email. I prefer email. Everyone wants to talk to me on Facebook Messenger, and I'm like, I can't keep track of 40 different communication methods. So I try to push people into email, because I guess I'm old fashioned.
Hey, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. And to see Steve after probably since 2000, maybe at Unicon in China.
Yeah. What a strange coincidence. I just walked in through the front door and he was there in the lobby. He's like, okay, it's Steve. And I said, Steve, no, I'm interviewing. I'm talking to John Foss. He went, really? Okay. Let me say hello. Don't tell him. Let me surprise him.
This was Meet the Entertainers, and I am Big Ben. Each episode takes a surprisingly large number of hours to prepare, record, and edit, and check, and re-edit, and re-record, and edit again, and throw in the bin, and mend my computer, and take it out of the bin, and redo it from scratch, and then post it again. So, if you're getting something out of this series, here are three things you can do. Number one, you can financially support this podcast by going to www.thebigbenshow.com/podcasts and making a financial donation of any amount you like. Number two, subscribe or share these podcasts or give me a good review on iTunes. And thirdly, get in touch. I'm always looking for more people to interview. My email is ben@thebigbenshow.com. Many thanks. Talk to you again soon.